Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Today in the Gospel, Jesus is confronted by the Pharisees and the Jewish community at large with a woman caught in adultery. He tells the crowds about, he basically tells the crowds, if anyone wishes to stone her, let he who has not sinned cast the first stone. And then he invites the woman to go forth and sin no more. I want to talk about that reading with Doug Keck. Doug joins us as he does every week and very generously with his time. And he and I are going to address the significance of this story and also that exhortation, go forth and sin no more. And it, in light of a culture that has moved into a therapeutic model of divinity, in other words, God is there to help me feel good about myself. In fact, therapy exists to help me feel good about myself, and everyone else is here to validate my feelings of the self. And Doug and I have spoken before about Jean-Jacques Rousseau as one of the intellectual founding fathers of this movement of expressive individualism. Jesus' words would therefore fly in the face of that narrative. Jesus was not one to ask everyone to hold hands and sing Kumbaya and validate every one of our moral choices just because they pleasure us. If anything, Jesus would be the first to tell us, if no one condemns you, neither do I condemn you. Go forth and sin no more. That still remains a central and crucial Christian call. After that, I will be speaking with Dr. Andrew Kubik. A British appeals court has ruled against a hospital that withdrew life-sustaining treatment from a patient without family approval. This is a step in the right direction that the British Appeals Court ruled against the hospital, but there's a lot of work to be done across the pond for the dignity of the human person and the preservation of the dignity of life in the areas of abortion, euthanasia, and assisted suicide. Andrew will be joining us to talk about this. And then finally, we will speak with Mike Schramm. Amongst St. Thomas Aquinas' most important contributions is his discourse on faith and reason. For him, the foundation of all human intellect is the presence of a rational soul. So what would he say about a soulless AI program's ability to quote-unquote reason? Would he even call that reason at all? Mike Schramm joins us to discuss this. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, March 23rd. It's the Feast of St. Rebecca. Today's news brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. In his Sunday Angelus, Pope Leo XIV warned that the death and suffering brought about wars are a scandal to the human race and a cry before God. As the Pope made his appeal, it's becoming reported that more than 1,000 are believed to be killed in Lebanon, 160 were injured by Iranian missile strikes in Israel on Sunday, and more than 1,400 have been killed in Iran. Wall Street is closing higher after President Trump said the U.S. and Iran held productive talks and will hold off targeting Iranian energy infrastructure. Oil prices dropped below $90 a barrel. At the closing bell, the major indexes all closed higher than 1%. ICE agents are going to the nation's airports to help TSA agents who have been working without pay. Monica Nelson reports.
The partial government shutdown has led to missed paychecks for the agents, and many have called out sick and in some cases quit their jobs altogether. ICE agents are helping with crowd control as lines at some security checkpoints have been long due to the staffing shortage. It comes as Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport has told travelers to arrive at least 4 hours early because of the wait times.
New York's LaGuardia Airport is reopened after a deadly crash involving an Air Canada jet and a vehicle happening last night. The pilot and co-pilot of the plane were killed and dozens were injured in the collision. Catholic leaders in one of India's most populous states are demanding the repeal of a new law that criminalizes religious conversion. The 13th such measure enacted across the country under the ruling Hindu nationalist government. A coalition of 35 civil rights, social action, Muslim, and Christian groups have condemned the bill as a threat to constitutional freedom. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mark Speter, talking with my friend Doug Kick of EWTN about today's gospel reading that comes straight out of John chapter 8. It has to do with the adulterous woman. Doug, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me.
Always a joy to be able to reconnect with you. Now, this story about the adulterous woman, there's a lot that we can comment on this, especially with regard to social life, chief among which I want to begin with that sense of an overt rigidity, which we can sometimes see resurge in church life. I want to invite you to comment on that.
Well, I think you have that when things get so lax, you'll always tend to get the pendulum swinging sometimes too far, and people get very pharisaical in the sense of getting caught up in the letter of the law rather than the heart of the law, basically, and certainly the intention of what the law was, and how much, you know, sin is not just something, as we can see here, our Lord is talking about, not just something that's an outward mistake or something. It has to do with inner issues in the interior life. And that's why, you know, he's willing to forgive people, you know, and say, go and sin no more, meaning, you know, your future is up to you. But the idea that that means it's okay, he never says that, obviously. And it's interesting, too, because I was reading something that Augustine talked about, the idea of saying he never said that they couldn't stone her. He just said that whoever wants to start should be somebody without sin. And so that was the challenge to them. And obviously the oldest or the wisest realized the first what he was saying. And obviously with him writing in the dirt as to whether he was writing their sins out or what that was. But that idea of people understanding that, you know, everybody sins. And so hence we can't be so quick to jump on everybody else and accuse them of things that we may be doing as well. That being said, means we should have mercy. We would want that mercy shown to us, and we should be showing that to others right away. And not looking at for an excuse to hold it over somebody and condemn somebody. And like I said, and he said, you know, it's like at the end, the Lord said, well, there's no one else here to condemn you, so I won't. That's an interesting way of saying he never said, and I'm not condemning you. He said, I'm doing it because no one else is here as well, so I'm willing to let that go too. But go and sin no more. And as you were talking about earlier, at the top of the hour, the problem we have in our society is everybody hears the, you know, okay, Jesus didn't do it. He didn't, you know, he chased the bad guys away and he let her go. But without the idea of catching, no, he's saying what she did was wrong. It's very wrong. It's against the Ten Commandments. How could he say that was okay? But he is willing to say, I'm willing to give you another chance. But this is a chance for you to straighten your life out, not to go on doing what you were doing.
And therefore, the wideness of God's mercy shouldn't be an occasion for us to act in presumption.
Well, there's a word you never hear anymore, which is presumption. You used to have the talk about the sin of presumption, you know, how everybody's going to heaven. Strikes me as one of the great sins of presumption. But yeah, presuming on God's mercy, you know, it's probably going to be there, but you can't do things that are against God's teachings and then assuming, well, he's going to cut me some slack on this because I'm a nice guy or because he's such a nice guy himself, without realizing you can't do that. If you're making these decisions and you know what's expected of you, then you have to live with the consequences that many times happen, especially in the temporal world, which we see where people are suffering after doing things that they thought they were, quote unquote, getting away with.
I love that you bring that up because very often the quote-unquote punishment for our sins is the consequence of what we ourselves have done.
Right, and exactly. And the problem is that we don't want to blame the victim. So, and you alluded to the idea of this idea of the therapeutic and having a child with special needs. You understand the therapeutic idea of these particular children have deficits and they need help and understanding because they clearly do. But it then gets projected onto the entire society where the reality is everybody is needs therapy. So nobody really is responsible for anything they do because it's really because of how they were brought up, or they were loved too much, they weren't loved enough, whatever you fill in the blank, there's some reason why, because all of us growing up in this world, as wonderful as our parents were and are, depending on our situation, there's probably times they said things that cut us to the quick or made us feel less important. Or, you know, that time I was at school and my friends all laughed at me. And now I don't feel as confident as I used to. And so I've done things I shouldn't do. There's lots of this idea that we're not responsible for our own actions. It's understandable why you could do something. It doesn't mean that it's acceptable.
Right. There still is a moral consequence. And so what Christ is doing here is providing absolution for the sin, but telling her to take responsibility.
Right. And it's the same thing with the idea when you see, you know, he's meeting with the tax collectors and these other people because he's trying to reach out to them. As he said, I didn't come for the for those who are healthy. I came for those who are sick. Well, who do you think he's talking about as being sick? He's talking about these people. So it's not that he's hanging around with these people because they're neat and they really got it right and they really understand him, man. They know how it is. They can play guitar. It's not that way at all. It's that these are the people he needs to reach because they're the ones who are really heading down the wrong path. You know, even our Lord said, you know, he didn't say don't do what the Pharisees said. He said don't do what they do. Okay? Because, yeah, they're saying, they're teaching things that are many months are exactly what the church is teaching or what was being taught, you know, for in Judaism at the time. But it's the fact that they were so hypocritical about it and following the letter of the law. With issues like donating money to the temple, etc., how they did these things where you didn't support your father or your mother because you were donating money here. So all of these kinds of, you know, machinations that really have nothing to do with living out your faith in any other way besides following the letter of the law, but there's no heart to the law.
And that heart to the law, that heart of the law is exactly what the gospel compels us to and what we ought to reclaim today, that we have the immense love of Christ, and responding to Christ means being responsible in changing our moral living.
Absolutely. And the call is on you. The responsibility is on her. Her responsibility is to change her life. Their responsibility is to realize that they're sinners too, and they're supposed to think about those sins that they, that our Lord wrote there or that they remembered when he called them on it and said, I have to make my life better too. So he's calling everyone, all the people there, to change their ways to be better people.
The funny thing is the Pharisees tried to trap Jesus, and as our Lord brilliantly does always, his response becomes a trap for them. I wonder if you just share your thoughts there.
No, absolutely. It's like, you know, render under Caesar what is Caesar's, you know, kind of thing where, again, the point that I think I read with Augustine made is, again, he didn't say that you couldn't stone her because that would be against the law of Moses, okay? So that's what they were trying to get him to do, to say, well, you can't do this. And they'd say, well, this is what Moses or what our faith tells us is supposed to happen. So now you're contradicting that. Instead, he has to say, you know, I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm just saying who of you is in a good enough personal situation in your own life that you have the right to do this to somebody like her?
And that therefore becomes an indictment on all of us, that right. While mercy is given to all of us, judgment is only given, is ultimately only God's, but that also means we can judge sins rightly.
Right. And the other thing is, that's the thing, who knows what kind of lifestyle she was living, who this person was in the situation that she sinned and stumbled and was wrong. But, you know, our Lord would look at them and say, you should know better. Okay, you're the Pharisee. You have all these sins in your lives, and you should know better to do these things. Here's maybe somebody who doesn't know as much or doesn't know better, and you're unwilling to give her the mercy that you expect God to show you.
Doug, tremendous joy. Thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you. Take it easy.
My guest has been Doug Kirk of EWT, and he and I have been talking about the story of today's gospel coming out of John chapter 8, Go Forth and Sin No More. Doug shared with us a tremendous amount of wisdom, chief among which is God has called us to responsibility for our moral actions, and he gives us the grace to live up to it. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Some time ago, a British appeals court ruled against a hospital that withdrew life-sustaining treatment from a patient without family approval. We're joined by my good friend, Dr. Andrew Kubik, to talk about this. Andrew wears many hats. He is Senior Research Fellow for Public Policy at the Catholic Healthcare Leadership Alliance and Ethics Consultant at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Andrew, great to speak with you again, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. It's great to be with you again as well.
For the sake of our listeners, let's go through the story and then we can talk about some of the Catholic insight into this.
Absolutely, and you did a great job in the lead-up as well. So last year in April 2025, a 68-year-old gentleman named Robert Barner suffered a stroke as well as subsequent strokes after that. He was clinically diagnosed with, and this is really a quote here, extensive and irreversible brain damage. However, despite that diagnosis, he did continue to show signs of responsiveness. So I'll just say for your listeners, this was not a case of whether or not he was what they call brain dead. Mm-hmm. He was very much alive, and there was not a question about that, but some of those signs of responsiveness included following people with his eyes. So when people were in the room, he would follow them with his eyes. He would blink on demand and even squeeze people's hands when he was holding it. However, it was during that time that he also suffered something called acute kidney injury. And acute kidney injury in his case required dialysis, what they call renal dialysis, twice a week. And it was that intervention, it was that medical intervention, the dialysis, that in late 2025, a group of clinicians, three of them, in fact, determined that it was clinically inappropriate, that was their words, to continue that dialysis. The family, of course, appealed, and it was during that appeal that the hospital, on February 11th, withdrew the dialysis. And shortly thereafter, he passed away. And as you noted in the lead-up, the hospital was found to be at fault for discontinuing dialysis while the courts were considering the appeal from the family.
The hospital withdrew treatment and withheld treatment as if they did it unilaterally, and they cited a clinical decision, or being the decision was made on clinical grounds. Can you please speak to that?
Sure, certainly. So what they were doing, and we find this in the United Kingdom's National Health Service, that when there is a patient who is considered incompetent or lacking the mental capacity to make one's own decisions, they defer to the family until the family is in disagreement with the clinical diagnoses and prognoses of the healthcare team. And that's what happened here. And so the clinical decision was in fact saying that it would be inappropriate to continue that dialysis. In fact, it would be inappropriate to continue that life-sustaining treatment, because that's exactly what it is.
In what does British law say about the kind of care that is mandated, especially in the case of a mentally incapacitated adult?
Sure. Sure. Well, it does fall down to the discretion of the clinicians, of the healthcare team, to determine. I mean, I'll use some Catholic bioethical terms here to really determine what is obligatory or what we call morally ordinary. So they're making the determination. Now, that is to say that the clinicians, the healthcare team, have a vital role in helping the family make decisions for patients who have lost the capacity to make decisions on their own. But for the National Health Service, there is a tremendous amount of authority given to the hospitals, given to the healthcare team. And when there is a conflict between the patient's families, for those who are incompetent to make those decisions, and the healthcare team, the preference goes, the authority goes to the healthcare team until, and in this case, it's appealed, but even there, the appeal can fail.
How long from the projected judge's announcement to his passing, like, would he have survived had the judge announced it earlier?
That's a great question, Marcus. We don't know a tremendous amount about the case. But given the fact that he was on this dialysis long-term, and it seemed, and again, I'm only speculating here, but it seemed like he was doing well with it, because there was no evidence to suggest they were withdrawing it because the intervention was futile. I would presume that he would have continued to live on this until evidence would say otherwise.
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, everything I've read about the case communicates exactly that. Could you also share with us, was it, it wasn't just one doctor who made this decision unilaterally?
It wasn't, no, it was a group of three doctors. It was a group of three, what they call clinicians, who made this declaration, this clinically inappropriate designation or label for the continued renal dialysis, which again was life-sustaining for this gentleman.
And amongst the three, and even other clinicians in the hospital, no one voiced objections or moral or conscientious objections?
Not that I've read. I haven't seen any reports that there were any objections within the hospital system, only by the family of Robert.
In a situation like this, then, from a Catholic perspective, especially here in the United States, if our listeners find themselves or find out about situations like this, what would be some proper moral courses of action to be taken immediately?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. I think one of the most important things I can emphasize to your listeners is the fact that this dialysis, this renal dialysis, could have been determined to be extraordinary. Again, we don't know the intricacies of this case. It wasn't publicly reported. But there could have been evidence to support, and this is the key terms here, that there wasn't a reasonable hope of it benefiting him. And to be quite honest, Marcus, as you and I just admitted speculatively, it was benefiting him. But I think the question is, were there excessive burdens that couldn't be reasonably managed? We don't know to what extent he was experiencing burdens due to the dialysis. But Catholic moral teaching is very clear. If there's a reasonable hope of benefit and there are not excessive burdens, then we have a moral obligation to continue. if there is not a reasonable hope of benefit, or if there are excessive burdens, and I usually add can't be reasonably managed, then it falls to the moral discretion or becomes morally optional, the prudential judgment of the family. Now, with regard to if that were to happen here, fortunately in the United States, still, now this is imperfect to say the least, but overwhelmingly the authority is granted to the family or specifically the healthcare proxy or agent. There's a lot of different names for the person who is designated to make decisions for the patient who cannot on his or her own. But that authority is overwhelmingly granted to that individual. And if, God forbid, a family would find themselves in that circumstance, then I would just highly recommend they have a very quick conversation. When I say quick, immediately with a patient advocate or with maybe if there's a social worker on the case, have it raised to the level of the bioethics committee. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to start with this, but if it becomes absolutely necessary, to seek out the local jurisdiction, the local judge or magistrate, to see if there could be a temporary injunction put in place to prevent the hospital from acting against the wishes of the family until this can be further pressed out. But I want to kind of close with an emphasis decision, and I'm going to read real quick for you and your listeners. ERD, Ethical and Religious Directive 56 from the U.S. Conference of Bishops, mm-hmm. tells us that the determination about whether there's a proportionate benefit or excessive burdens falls to the patient or the patient's surrogate and should be informed by professional medical advice. So it's the patient or the patient's surrogate that is the decision maker.
I really thank you for all of that. Gosh, we're out of time. Every time I speak with you, the time just flies. Andrew, thank you very much for your insights. We're going to include ways to contact you and your work in the description. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me on again, Marcus.
My guest has been Dr. Andrew Kubik. He, like I mentioned, wears many hats. Right now, he's Senior Research Fellow for Public Policy at the Catholic Healthcare Leadership Alliance and Ethics Consultant at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. We've been talking about the unfortunate story of a man who was taken off medical care in the UK. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
How does freedom affect our actions? According to the Catholic Catechism, freedom makes us responsible for every act that we have directly willed. Despite her efforts to place all the blame on the serpent, Eve was directly responsible for initiating and committing original sin. She knew God had forbidden her to eat from the tree of good and evil, yet she did it anyway. Cain deliberately killed his brother Abel. King David deliberately committed both adultery and murder. None of the three were ignorant of the gravity of their acts, and there were no mitigating circumstances that diminished their responsibility. However, David was particularly remorseful when confronted with his guilt. The Catechism tells us that the right to the exercise of freedom, especially in moral and religious matters, is an inalienable requirement for the dignity of the human person. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
60 on 10 with Monsignor Charles Pope.
The fourth commandment, honor your father and your mother. This commandment enjoins on us young children not only obedience to their parents and even older children, great honor for them, but also gratitude for all of our elders, teachers, employers, and leaders. It also directs citizens to a proper love of our country. So it's a rich commandment. And it also puts great requirements on those who are in those positions to be worthy of the honor that is due them. This commandment is fundamentally given to us by God because without respect for our elders, there can be no teaching, and we cannot hand on the wisdom of previous generations. This commandment is rich and it is for us. The fourth commandment, honor your father and your mother.
For more about the Ten Commandments, visit EWTNRC.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Among St. Thomas Aquinas' most important contributions is his discourse on faith and reason. For Aquinas, the foundation of all human intellect is the presence of a rational soul. So what would he say about a soulless artificial intelligence program's ability to quote-unquote reason? We're joined by Mike Schramm. Mike lives in southeastern Minnesota with his bride and seven children. There, he teaches theology and philosophy at Aquinas High School and Viterbo University. He earned his MA in theology at St. Joseph's College in Maine and an MA in philosophy from Holy Apostles College. He's written for Busted Halo, Homiletic and Pastoral Review, and the Voyage Comics blog. Mike, great to speak with you. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having me, Dr. Peters.
Let's, if I may, invite you to start by being candid. How much of an issue is artificial intelligence presenting to the kind of work you're doing?
Yeah, so, in the classroom and education, it's definitely one of the, I mean, it's talked about everywhere, but it's talked about in, like, every teacher conference, in every workshop, in every training that we have is always this sort of how do we address this issue. And it's also just, you know, in the kind of circles that I'm in, like the types of articles that I like to read, every other teacher online is talking about it or university professor is talking about it. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's pervasive. It's ubiquitous. It's whether it's teachers using it, you know, and all the scandal that causes or professors using it and the scandals that causes. And then obviously the students using it and where the academic integrity is, you know, in terms of writing papers or even just trying to have, class discussions, right, and how much it hampers students' ability to comprehend and then to apply certain ideas.
So tell us then about this question that we're addressing here, which is the question of reasoning, even before we get deeper into how Aquinas thinks about this. Is artificial intelligence really doing the work of reasoning? What is reasoning?
Yeah, so, faculties of the mind, we're talking about like the intellect, right? Because that's when we think of the reason, we're talking about that part of that power of the soul where it's not just the collection of information, right? Like almost like on a computer where it can like take in all the information and just sits there, but it's also the articulation of it or the application of it. Or, you know, one of the things that we talk about in education in terms of higher level thinking skills is evaluation and synthesis. So when you can determine, you know, how much does an idea conform to reality, that means that you have to understand the idea, but then you also have to see how it would apply to, you know, the quote unquote real world. And then same thing with synthesis, where you're taking two seemingly disparate ideas and you're bringing them together. What's good about one idea? What's good about another idea? How can you kind of fuse them together into something completely new? That's that higher level thinking that goes beyond just the putting something onto a page, right, or onto a word processor.
In other words, the way the intellectual rational soul reasons is distinct and vastly different from what we seem to think artificial intelligence is doing in reasoning.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, like, one of the things that, you know, and this I'm starting to kind of draw a little bit from the article, is Aquinas applies the, or takes the idea of the intellect, because the intellect is the power of the soul. Well, that means that that reasoning has to kind of be aligned with the soul itself, right? So there has to be something alive, something living,
yep,
in whatever thing is doing the reasoning in that case.
In that light, when we consider the kind of production, if you will, of text, of think, quote-unquote thinking, that artificial intelligence does, all it does is it aggregates the resources that it has to provide an estimation of an answer. It's not real thinking and reasoning.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, when you put actual, like, letters or words on a page, whether it's, you know, a typewriter, printing press, or even a processor, is the thing that actually puts the words on there hasn't actually done the thinking, right? It's the person who aligned the letters. And even if you're going to take a step back and say, well, it's the program that aligned the letters, well, then there still is something sort of like behind the alignment of that program, so to speak. So you're really just kicking the can back an extra step by doing it digitally instead of, you know, like I said, you put the slides in on the printing press and you actually, you know, put the press down, to use a, you know, the older technology.
Tell us about this power of the soul that is the intellect. You've got the intellect, the will, the passions, and the... Sorry about that. And they each have their own appetites, the appetite of the intellect being the truth. So that's why a human person has a desire to know for the sake of apprehending truth. Can you please speak to that?
Yeah, so as I was saying before, Aquinas, what I thought was so interesting in kind of doing the research for this, and actually just kind of a connection that I found, you know, with Ave Maria, because this paper that I wrote, it was actually originally a presentation for the Aquinas conference at Ave Maria University, is where I first presented it. And then I wanted to kind of put it down into something in writing. He aligns it with the soul, right? And the soul is the thing that gives life to, whether it's a plant, an animal, or a human, right? It's the capacity for life is what we call the soul. And so the question that you have to ask too is, like, what if even is life in the first place? Because most, like, when they think of, like, oh, well, if it's moving, it's alive. But we can think of things, whether we're building a machine, the machine can move, but it's not alive in the same way that an organism is alive. And so there's this distinction, which is basically, it's called, like, immanent movement or transient movement. And immanent movement is the movement being brought on by something that is part of the nature of the thing itself? Mm-hmm. Or if it's transient, is the movement being caused by something that is external to the thing itself? And the example that I use in the paper is, so you have a living organism, which is, you know, not only does the organism have DNA and has a heart that pumps blood, but, like, there's something that's even enlivening that heart. And that's why we would call it, you know, the soul, because the soul has to give life to the heart, the lungs, and the brain simultaneously for all those things to work together. As opposed to transient, which is, like I said, something external, that'd be something more like a battery. So now you can kind of see the contrast between the biological kind of real life thing and then the more mechanical. And when we look at something like, you know, even if it's the movement, so to speak, of a program in a computer or artificial intelligence, so-called, it still is being brought on by something extrinsic to the thing itself, whether it's the code that was put in or the programmer that put the code in, right, or whatever the case may be. It still is something external. It's not intrinsic to the thing we're talking about. And so that's kind of the first really big, I think, important distinction that Aquinas makes when he's talking about the intellect, is that if the intellect is tied to the soul, and the soul is the capacity for life, and that's what life is that immanent movement that's brought on by the thing itself and not, like I said, something external to it, then that's kind of where, you know, you really can't square that circle, so to speak.
One of the things, therefore, that results in is AI doesn't have what Aquinas, what the church would consider properties of life, real life. Please speak to that before we address the deeper anthropological issues.
Yeah, so I guess, did you mean something more beyond just the, like I said, the imminent movement versus the transient movement, or was there something kind of separate that you were thinking of? Or
well, I guess in a specific way, what I'm referring to is that it by itself doesn't possess an intellectual rational nature, and so its very existence is contingent upon the imitation. It is a simulacra of nature.
Okay. Yeah, so
we're going to have to take a break. Continuing on the other side of the break with what St. Thomas Aquinas can teach us about artificial intelligence. We're joined by Mike Schramm, who's recently penned this piece in What We Need Now, the Substack. Aquinas articulates artificial intelligence. And one of the issues that we're getting to is the heart of what the church teaches about the human person, what Christ teaches about the human person. Continuing on the other side, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology.
I'm Dr. Jeff Morrow. This Easter season, I invite you to join myself, the Mercedarian Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament, and Father Boniface Hicks for the St. Paul Center's Easter Challenge. Together, we will gain practical insights into prayer, intimacy with the Holy Spirit, and learn how to accompany others through Christ's own example. Visit stpaulcenter.com/Easter to learn more.
Hello, friends. Deacon Harold Burke Sivers here, and I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com. to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Here's the new challenge. At least 1 hour a week in front of the Blessed Sacrament with the goal of an hour a day in front of the Blessed Sacrament. I had a guy come up to me and he says, Father, you know, I'm doing a lot of things. I'm in a men's fellowship. I pray with my wife every day. I go to Mass every Sunday and usually a couple times during the week. I read scripture. He goes, I want more. I said, do you pray in front of the Blessed Sacrament? He said, outside of Mass, no. I said, I think that's the more. See, all these saints, these are the ones who surround us. These are the ones who ran before us. These are the ones who fought well, who kept the faith. They would tell you, as would every single saint in heaven right now, you cannot run this race if you don't spend time with the Master. Whatever else we're doing, it's second, third, and fourth. First things need to be first. And the first thing is to be with the Master. And the Master is Jesus.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
You've probably heard Venerable Father Patrick Peyton say, the family that prays together stays together. Well, as the director of the Peyton Institute, I like to add that the family that plays together also prays together. Family play rituals, like family days, game nights, and other similar activities, aren't just fun things to do. They're ways Catholic families remind each other to celebrate the life God has given them. Daily play rituals remind families that both in good times and in hard times, God always wants us to look for reasons to rejoice. That's one reason family rituals for playing together are such an important part of Catholic family life. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peet. I'm talking with Mike Schramm. He is most recently the author of Aquinas Articulates Artificial Intelligence on the What We Need Now Substack. So, Mike, to pick up where we were just talking about, AI can present an imitation of human nature and human intellect, but it never actually is real intelligence. I invite you to comment from there.
Yeah, so one of the things that that Aquinas talks about when he's talking about the intellect is he refers to what are called the sensitive powers, and that these sensitive powers, they consist of these four, the sensitive part of the soul, I should say, and they consist of these four interior powers. The first one he gives is the common sense, the imagination, the estimative sense, and then the memorative powers. And so what you can do is you can say, okay, if the intellect consists of these four things, and I can kind of define them in a second, then something we need to have all four of them in order to think according to, you know, to use the intellect to think, so to speak. And, you know, the memorative, you can kind of guess what it has to do with memory, right? With keeping and holding on to stuff. And that's probably the one that one could argue an artificial intelligence or like a, you know, a computer of some kind could have. It has this really high capacity for memory, much higher than any individual human can have. But then when you start getting into and actually the same thing with the estimative powers. That's one of the things that we've been able to do really, really well with algorithms or with formulas is we can make really good estimates if we're the ones putting the right data in. But it still takes that, you know, that person to know which data is relevant in order to put it into the formula, if that makes sense. But then when you get to the imagination and the common sense, that's where it starts to become harder to argue that anything that's so-called artificial intelligence could really participate in the powers of the intellect. So the imagination, and this is where, like I said, it gets a little bit tricky because we've probably seen some of those like AI-generated images before, right? And they look very similar to, you know, you take pictures that you have seen out in the world, and then you try to create something in your mind, right? So you know the concept of gold, you know the concept of a mountain, so in your head you can create an image of a golden mountain. But what the common sense does is the common sense, is supposed to bring all of those things together. And that's where, like I said, we still haven't been able to, you know, we don't see an artificial intelligence that's able to do this. And actually, if you read some artificial intelligence experts, they're saying that it doesn't have the capacity to do this. Because what it needs to do is it needs to be able to take all of those kind of disparate ideas or disparate pieces of information, but it needs to bring it all under one sort of umbrella that it knows this is what it is. And we can have examples where it does something like that, but only because it's been told by something outside of it, that's what it is. Does that make sense?
So it has been told, meaning it's human interaction that has conditioned it to recognize is by itself a misnomer when it comes to AI, but to acknowledge that this is what it is, and then to be able to create an imitation of it. In that sense, then, when human beings interact with AI chatbots, it's proper to say that there's something human in the answers, if you will, because human coding and human language preceded what the chatbot can do.
Yeah, so I mean, the human element is there has been put in there extrinsically already, which, I mean, we can, it's sort of like, you know, we do this with when people will anthropomorphize animals, mm-hmm. right? When you think of, like, we look at an animal and we think that it's thinking what we would think if we were in that animal situation. And even though somebody can tell us that's not actually how the animal is thinking, we can't help but project that way of thinking onto the animal, right? And that's why we do it in our cartoon movies, or we even just do it with animals out in the street or out in the wild. And again, it's just that's we have it sort of like built into us. Well, the same kind of projection or anthropomorphizing that we do with animals, we can do with machines too, right? It just maybe makes us a little bit more uncomfortable to do it, but like we do the same thing. And it's the same thing with thinking.
And that anthropomorphization, when it comes to animals, there's already serious concerns, epistemological and moral challenges. But when it comes to something like artificial intelligence, present to us some of the moral issues that can bring up.
Well, I mean, because it is so powerful, and because it can resemble it much better, you know, just to kind of use the animal example that we've been talking about as an analogy, we can still take a step back and look and say, oh, but that isn't a human because it looks enough like not a human. But and it doesn't actually talk back to us. But when we have something that can use a very realistic looking picture, and we're so used to not seeing people's real faces, we're just used to seeing their pictures, their avatars on the screen, and it can talk to us and resemble that so well, that's when it starts to become, you know, that's when it becomes so powerful. And, you know, it has this very strong influence on people. Actually, one of the things that inspired me to write the article, I didn't include the news story in the article itself, but there have been some articles of people who have been so affected by these, like they've been so invested in these relationships, and then these chatbots will tell them to do something, you know, destructive, and they'll do it. Yeah. And so that's kind of the power that it's had. And it was a recent, even though the original story that kind of got me to write this, that it's now become an older story, it happened again more recently. So it's like, it's still happening, even though the original, you know, story that inspired it, the article that I wrote, has now become an older article. Like, it's going to keep, like, it's just going to become a recurring thing.
And therein lies perhaps one of the greatest issues, especially for young minds being formed, that the reality of navigating relationships is already tough enough. But when you have this thing that creates a pseudo-relationship because it is by itself being presented to be human when it effectively isn't, the temptation to create these ersatz relationships becomes all too real for young people. As a teacher and also as a young man, can you comment on that?
Yeah. So, you know, as you mentioned in my bio, I've been married for several years, have many kids. And so I was married long before this particular issue, you know, was relevant in terms of dating and relationships, fortunately. But I do see, you know, just in talking with my students who are, you know, they're either 18 or older, because I have seniors in high school and then I have college students. And so, you know, it is something that, like, they're all very much well aware of. I think, at least from my perspective, what I've been able to see is that they have a lot of the resources to pursue. Most of the ones that I have anyway have the resources and the opportunities to pursue real flesh and blood relationships, whether that's friendships or romantic relationships. And so, you know, it isn't something that, like, it's not like I have a conversation with a student. They're like, oh, and I was talking to, you know, so-and-so the other day, and I said, oh, who's that? And they're like, oh, it's my, you know, AI girlfriend or AI. Like, I haven't had that happen yet, fortunately. Mm-hmm. But just the fact that I have to bring that up as a plausible example is maybe the worrisome part, right?
Exactly. And the sheer ubiquitousness of mental issues in every subsequent generation also presents severe problems. I don't know which specific case you were referring to, but I know at least of three separate cases where this has become a problem. We've had one of the mothers of a young boy who tragically ended his life because of an AI chatbot on this program. Mm-hmm. And so this is a real problem. Every life lost has infinite value in Christ. And therefore, just for parents who are listening right now, if you can speak to them, not just as a parent, but also as a theologian, philosopher, To help them understand that what their children are interacting with are not real people, and therefore even that requires tremendous supervision.
Well, and I think ultimately, like, when it comes to so many of these, you know, whether we're talking moral issues or in some ways this is a deeper anthropological issue than just making the right decision, is it comes down to we've been given so many great gifts, right? Not only is our life, our existence itself such a great gift, but in a special case, our human intellect is such a great gift. Mm-hmm. And to kind of throw it away, right? It's sort of like the Jacob and Esau, where it's like you're trading your birthright for a bowl of, you know, soup. And in this case, like for ease, for comfort, to give such a great gift away, in this case, not only is it that capacity to reason, but like you've already mentioned, our capacity to reason has an integral part to the relationships that we form. And so it doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean like the smartest people have the best relationships, but the capacity to reason is an essential part of knowing somebody and loving somebody. And so it's foundational to our friendships, our marital relationships, our relationships with our children. And so to relinquish that, you know, so easily is, it shouldn't scare us. It should embolden us to strengthen that gift all the more.
Well, Mike, it's been a real joy speaking with you. How can people follow your work or find out more about what you're doing?
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for having me. So you mentioned that this article was for the What We Need Now Substack. I do have my own, which I usually publish like any of my articles that I write, not only for What We Need Now, but for any other publications. I've written for other ones as well. And so I try to put it all there on my own Substack, which is just, you know, Mike Schramm is all it is. So you can just find it on there. And I'd say that's probably the best place in terms to find my work and my other articles and things like that.
Well, thank you very much. We will be linking to your Substack in the description of today's program. My guest has been Mike Schramm. He lives in southeastern Minnesota with his bride and 7 children, teaches theology and philosophy at Aquinas High School in Viterbo University. And we've been talking about what St. Thomas Aquinas would tell us about artificial intelligence. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.